When you first talked about, you have to
Yeah,
identify it or
I do
anything.
have to identify it, make sure it's working and all that. Today's March 14th,
Yeah, right.
1996. This is Karen Brewster speaking with John Schindler, his home in Anchorage. And we're going to talk about Harry Brower and probably about Gnarl.
Probably about anything we can think of.
Okay, sounds good. Let me just stop it and. Okay. We're back on.
Yeah, okay. Well, when we first started, you first raised the idea of talking about Harry. I started thinking, as well as I know Harry, or excuse me, knew Harry, it's really hard to think of specific instances or things. Harry was such a laid-back, easygoing person. And don't get me wrong, he was a very strong man. He was extremely, he just had his own opinions, but he never pushed anything. If you want to talk about Annie, my God, there's a thousand things that Annie did, you know, to cause trouble. But Harry, in fact, Harry and Annie were the ultimate about opposites attract. And
really?
Just unbelievably. I can tell you stories about Annie where she's riding across the tundra on a ski-doo in a race. I can still remember this. And what day did was the race? This was must have been Memorial Day or something, late in the spring anyway. And the hood on the ski-doo comes up.
Oh, no.
Annie's not going to give up. Annie stands up, throws her leg over the top, holds the hood down, comes in like that, standing up, you know. Typical of Annie's. And Harry, who probably didn't as many things as Annie, but did them so very quietly and just went about his own thing. You know. A wonderful good friend. In fact, I remember just waiting for you. I started thinking about Harry, and he gave me a tie tack just not too long before he died, actually. It's a whale carved out of baleen. Mm-hmm. I just went and looked it up. I've never had it changed to the kind that you, you know, it's on a clip, and they never wear that kind, so I've never worn it. And in fact, here's a. No. That's a Harry. Harry was always giving us stuff.
That's pretty.
Oh, his whalebone carvings.
I haven't seen any of his whalebone. I've only ever seen his ivory. I have some. Mm-hmm. The ivory and the baleen boats.
I think. I don't think he did our baleen. I don't remember. That's definitely, he just made that for me and brought it in and gave it to me. Yeah.
This looks like it may have been one of his early pieces.
Oh, yeah. This is about 63, 4, something like that. It's a while ago. But he, you know, even the whale that he did just before he died, that little whale tie tack. I used to stop at the house after I had left Barrow, and then every chance I got, I'd go out and visit, you know. And we'd just sit there and drink coffee. Usually there was a grandchild or two around, you know, to tease. And I tried to think of what the heck did we talk about. And, you know, I really can't tell you. I was just perfectly at ease with Harry. He was that type of a person who always enjoyed his company. He did a great deal of trapping. I don't know if people have told you that, but he spent many an hour out running fox traps. In fact, there is a cute story that probably Max will tell you too, which
it's okay.
Everybody loves. In fact, it was Erna. My wife, Annie, was making her a Christmas dress, which turned out to be like a parka type, only not open, just a one piece with a hood, and she was going to, it was all red velvet or something, and she was going to put a white fox thing on it so she'd wear it at the Christmas party. And she was over there getting, with Annie, getting it fitted or something, and they were laughing, and you have to have known Annie to understand this, because it was a constant stream of jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Never stopped. And then Harry would just sit there and smile, you know, that was it. You very seldom got words out of Harry when Annie was around. You know? So she was going to put this white fox on Erna's dress, this trim around the rough part. She says she couldn't do it. And my wife, of course, says, well, what do you mean? Harry traps lots of foxes. And it turned out that a couple of days before, Harry had decided to send all the fox skins to have them tanned, but they were looking dirty. So he put them in Annie's new automatic wash machine. And they were picking pieces of fox fur out of that wash machine for days. Harry has never admitted to me that he did that.
I remember that story.
It just tickled the hell out of me. Oh, he's going to be neat. Clean him up.
That's right. And what's this new washing machine I paid for?
Yeah.
It's just sitting here, right?
It's just such a... And that was so typical of this man. He just went through life. You know, he took his knocks. There's another favorite story that I'm sure Max will love to tell you. He traveled his trap line so much, and he was religious about it, you know. A lot of guys would put a trap line out, and they'd leave it out a week. Harry would run his trap line sometime in the middle of the night, early in the morning, and then come to work at 8 o'clock, you know. He never, never missed it. And he got to the point... There was a polar bear denning out there, and I think this was on the southwest side, just down below Spell Cliff, if I remember correctly. And she had cubs, and as the season went on and he was still running the line, he started taking bits of seal meat with him and throwing them out for this polar bear. Well, in time, he got so friendly with a sow and two cubs, if you can imagine this. She let the cubs crawl up in his lap on Ski-Doo.
Oh, my goodness.
It was just, you know, when you think about this, this is unbelievable. In fact, we used to tease Annie about, Harry's got another girl, you know, a white girl, too, you know. And give her the hardest time. But that's the type of a person he was. He had tremendous patience. And he was so easygoing and so laid back. He could do this sort of thing. This was, it's very hard to talk about Harry in, how I say this, you know, in specific instances. Because so much of the time we were just sitting there, just enjoying each other's company. Harry was working at the lab when I first got there in 1960. He was what we called second carpenter in those days. Eddie Hobson was lead carpenter. Harry was second. And then Eddie went to work for the BIA and moved all over Alaska as their chief carpenter, building schools everywhere they were building them in those days. And Harry moved up into the lead carpenter position. And let's see, that was 60. In the spring of 61, we hired a shop foreman by the name of John Beck. I was just talking about Nancy Beck. Okay. She married John's brother, him. And John Beck became, and Harry became so close as good friends, and yet they never, you know, if you would have said, oh, you're a good friend, you know, type response you would get. And yet John made sure there was always presents for the kids in the Brower House at Christmas. You know, they always got turkeys and hams and this sort of thing, and Harry took care of John likewise. They were really very, very good friends. And good, they worked well together, because both of them are the same, very capable but yet not very demonstrative, you know, type of persons. John's still alive, by the way. We stopped and see him the last time we were outside.
Where does he live?
He lives just up north of Seattle. A little town called, the hell is the name of it again? Sunday Lake Road is what he lives on, but I can't remember the name of the town. It's, you wouldn't know it anyway. It's just a post office, really. But it's only about 30 miles north of Seattle. Huh. Harry and I used to... First got really to know Harry was that year we were making, that summer they were making what they called the Arliss buildings, and Harry was I think he was in charge of that, even though Eddie was being Carpenter. It seems to me Eddie was doing something else, and Harry was in charge of that. And I was not on the lab staff. I was a scientist then, so about the only connection we would have is if I would go to the shop or they would come over for the coffee break and they'd sit in the coffee room. And that's really when I got to know Harry. In those days, it was a totally different world. It's hard to explain. But the lab, even though we had, I think we were 80% of our staff was Native, we didn't really socialize except on certain occasions. You'd go to the school things with them, or you'd go to Christmas parties. But people really didn't stop at each other's houses. You know what I mean? It was just not done. It was a different time. Yeah. It really was. And I think the first house that I ever went into was Harry's.
Yeah.
Harry and Annie's. Yeah. And even then, you could tell that the other people, not Harry, I don't remember if Annie was there now, but not Harry, but the other people were uneasy. You know, it was just, and when Kenny, that was the other friend we had, Kenny Tubach, and his wife, Thelma, would come to visit us, Kenny was totally at ease, because we worked with Kenny every day, and, you know, we knew each other very well. But I can still remember Thelma sitting there, with maybe Kenny Jr., I don't remember, one of the little kids with her, in her parka, she'd never take it off. First sight, inside, she's just sweating like crazy. But to take it off, you had to be a relative. Mm-hmm. And because we were white, she just could not make that step.
Even in her own home?
No, this was when she visited. And she would come and she would never take her parka. She would sit there for 2 hours, you know. And it'd just be dying of the heat. It would just kill me. But it was just different in those days. It was just totally different.
Yeah. And I understand that. And that's what, I wasn't there, I don't know what it was like, and that's interesting, because I have read in some of the things that officially NARL personnel weren't supposed to go to town.
Oh no, we discouraged that very strongly, because the young bucks would just go over to town for one thing, thing only, or they'd go over to town and take liquor, and it was a dry village in those days, and so we were desperately trying to keep the liquor out of the village. That was the big problem. So, and that went on for years, really, until almost the first 10 years I was at the lab, it was like that. All the way into the 70s when things started to change. Then, land claims, and they got their own things to do. Because when we, Max and I, and Tommy Brower, and Lord, can't remember the name of the banker, started the Chamber of Commerce in Barrow, 62-63. It was a big deal to go to the meetings once a month in the village. Because everything prior to that just never included white men. There were a few white men in the village, mostly bush pilots. Bush pilots and the doctor or dentist at the hospital, and that was it. And the Weather Bureau band, And maybe one male teacher in the school system or two. That went up and down and changed all the time. But, and even those people, really, we'd go over there and socialize with the teachers and stuff, but you just really didn't. And yet, I think now I was closer to Harry and to Kenny than it was to any of those white people ever, And yet you just didn't do these things. Harry and Annie I can't remember them ever moving out to the Point in the summertime, which a lot of people did. Have you ever heard of the duck camp?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in those days, that was their summer resort, the duck camp.
Still is.
But Harry and Annie, I don't think, did it. Pete and Isa did, Kenny and Thelma did, but Harry and Anna didn't. So I'm not too sure. He used to go by boat, though. And now that I think of that, Harry didn't go east very often.
That's strange. I never thought of that before. You go to the Inaru, and maybe as far east as the Ikpikpuk. But usually he was to the west, towards Wainwright, down in that area. And maybe that's the reason they never went to the point, because he was always doing things, you know, I never thought of that before. So that's probably why. Though I can only remember them having a boat in the late 60s. I can't remember them having a boat earlier than that. I think it was Ronald that got it, not Eugene.
Well, Ronald was in the Navy, right?
Yeah, so maybe that was maybe that was why. I can't remember. It wasn't Eugene, that I'm pretty sure. That was tough on Harry when Eugene had all his political troubles. Annie died before that.
Before that.
Happened. Well, about the time that it was all coming to fruition. Mm-hmm. So Annie didn't really have to face many of those problems. And that it was so typical the way Harry, it's so typical of Harry the way he dealt with that. I would come out to see him. I'd say, "How's Eugene doing?" "Doing fine. You know. Everything going okay?" "A few problems." I say, "Well, Harry, we're here for him if he needs us." He says, "Me too." And that's it. You know, never an accusation, never a word. It was just that was just Harry's way. You know, and I'm sure he took Eugene aside a bit. Read him the riot act, you know, but you would never know it because that was not his. It was he was just not a demonstrative person, and yet you felt he was just as strong as a rock, you know, just as solid as could be. Great, great character. And you know, Annie and Erna used to. Oh God, they would tease like crazy. I think Erna was teaching Annie to bake cakes. That was it. Mary Lou and Erna, Mary Lou was Max's wife, and Erna really were on the Arts Council. You know what that is? Well, let's see, I don't even know what it was called officially. But it was a state organization that ran for many years, and they started up a chapter in Barrow to encourage the sewing and the handicrafts and the carving and all this business. And they got Annie involved in it after they first got going the first year. And then Annie really took it over after Mary Lou and Erna left. Well, she was an active in anything. She was on the school board, you name it. But she, well, to give you an idea of Annie, how she could tease, I was giving her a hard time. We were at the airport here. I'm at Barrow. Max is in Juneau. I got to stop in Juneau on my way out to see him. And I come down here to catch the plane, and there's Annie and a bunch of other people going to Juneau for some meeting. And I'm giving her a bad time. And she's teasing me. That's it. But, you know, let's go have a drink. And I said, "I can't have a drink with you. My wife would never let me have that. You know, blah, blah, blah. Erna would shoot me." And I was just really giving her a hard time. And finally, we got on the plane. I don't remember what happened. But we, of course, weren't sitting together. We were all separated. And I'm sound asleep, like I always did when I hit the plane. And all of a sudden, I wake up, and there's Annie kissing me right on the mouth. And she says, "Well, but you're going to tell Erna now." You know, and that's typical of Annie Brower. I mean, that's just the way she was. Everything she had an answer for, you know, or a way to handle. And I was so flabbergasted, I didn't know what to do. I never did see what they did on that trip. God, they went to their meeting, and I went to mine, and that was the last we saw of each other.
Well, Harry was the least to me. Harry was a big teaser.
Oh yeah, he was. How do I say this? He always had. But his teasing was always just a couple of words. It wasn't a big deal, you know. And that twinkle he'd get in his eye, that just would, you know, you knew when he was teasing because he had that look. You couldn't miss it, you know. But I can still remember I never really knew Harry probably as well as I did at the very end after Annie died, because I used to spend hours with him when I had the chance. Usually in the morning, because I didn't have meetings or things to go to, so I'd go over to the house and sit there and we'd drink coffee and just goof around and stuff. You know, I'm trying to think. Harry was what, 60?
67?
7 or 8.
Yeah.
So I think Harry and Max were almost the same age. And Max would be 72. 72 this year. So yeah, that'd be about right. Harry was 1 or 2.
Yeah, I think it's 4 years.
Well, he sure loved to carve, and yet he never talked about that unless he had a piece in front of him. I don't recall. And when we started the carver's hut, we actually set aside a Quonset, I don't know what's happened to it a few years later, and tried to set it up with a stove where the people could go and sit around on the floor and carve and sew and stuff like that. We call it the crafts house. I think it's behind where the fire department is. Is that where the fire is? That village has changed so much over the years.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's a big building that faces the beach. Well, it's the first street back from the beach.
On the barrel side?
Yeah, on the barrel side, not on the...
Oh, I know what you're talking about, I think.
I can't remember now what the use of that building is, but the crafts house used to be behind that whole complex would have been the old Catholic church.
Right, okay.
Which then, in those days, was in a Quonset also.
Right.
You know, it wasn't in the... And in between those two, somewhere, there was a hut that we put aside for the craftsmen.
And did people use it?
Yeah, because I was on the Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber paid the gas bill for, well, at least 2-3 years. Kept it heated in the winter so they could go over there and, you know, sit around and drink coffee, and that sort of thing. Yeah, we used to have fundraisers to pay for the gas and the electricity in that place so that they could use it. It didn't last too long, but about 3 years it was in business.
Did Harry go there?
I don't remember Harry ever using that. And though he lived not too far up the street there, you know, it's... But Chester Lampe used to go over all the time. And oh God, the memory of my name is terrible. His... No, not Pete, the fellow in the drum in the back.
Not Hap?
What's his first name?
Vincent.
Not yet. Embarrassed that I'm losing all those things, getting away from me.
You don't need to use them every day.
I don't anymore. That's really, you know, so unless we sit around and talk about barrel, I don't have any need for it. As you can see, we collected lots of garbage from barrel.
It's beautiful garbage.
Yeah, all over the years. I'm trying to remember if there's any stuff from Harry up there. I don't think so. Got some Chester stuff up there. If there is, I don't remember. That's bad.
So did Harry go out with this... he was a carpenter at Knob, but he also talks about going and doing all this other stuff all over the North Slope.
Well, he... See, we use the carpenter shop especially, and the mechanic shop for the vehicles, the vehicle shop, were almost totally Eskimo staffed. And whenever anyone would go in the field, and this was Max's rule, he never sent them out alone. He didn't trust them, to be honest with you. And the Eskimos could take care of themselves, so he would always send an Eskimo with them. And Harry, because it was easygoing nature, his command of English, he would spend a lot of time doing this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the winter, he'd be in the carpentry shop. And in the springs, he'd be lots of times out on the ice putting buildings together.
Oh, I thought he'd be out whaling.
Well, then he'd come back and go whaling. That's the long spring. And then in the summer, he'd probably be back at fish camp or be back in some river somewhere with some scientist. So he did all sorts of things. And I think he really liked the lab. Mainly because he got to meet so many people, to see so many different things. When I think back now, you know, we very selfishly, in many ways, used the people in the village, and yet, because they had something to offer us, and we had something to offer them, you know, it was really a great arrangement. I used to give the contractor on the other side of the street a hard time. I mean, you don't know what you're missing, you know, because they'd hire everybody off the streets in Fairbanks and bring them up. The support contractor, or the Dew Line, they seldom, the Dew Line especially, seldom hired natives. I think at one point there wasn't even a native in the entire line.
I thought they hired them to help build it, maybe.
Oh, but see, the Dew Line in Alaska was built in Barrow.
Oh.
Right in that camp.
Okay.
The Navy built that camp, and then, let's see, that would have been about 50... Oh, God, this is where you need Brewer. He got all these dates down like crazy. They closed in 52. They shut down the exploration of the petroleum reserve. Yeah, I think that was like January or February of 1952. It was one of Eisenhower's first things in office when he became president, was to kill the exploration of the reserve. And they closed the camp that year, and the only people left in the camp was the lab.
Okay.
And they held about 6 buildings open, you know, and kept the generators running, that sort of thing. And then the following year, 53, the Air Force had this big need to build the Dew Line. And they came in and they took over the camp. The Navy turned it over to them on a rental basis type of thing, you know, tenant, landlord basis. And then the Air Force brought in all their contractors, and they hired local people, the same ones the Navy had been using in the exploration mostly,
okay.
Came back out and applied for jobs, and they built them the Dew Line in that camp. So, and it was taken out across the tundra, mostly in the wintertime, and then those individual buildings were just shoved up there and all connected together. They were like all individual trailers.
Kind of
yeah, they were, well, you know what a Panacek sled is? The sled with made out of the big pipes.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay, that's a Panacek because the guy that was, Panacek was a, I don't know if he was a plumber or not, but he bent all those big drill pipes to make those, you know, he had the technology, he knew when they heated and they bent those, and he made all those sled runners, and so they're all called Panacek sleds. And they would put 2 units on a Panacek and haul it out across the snow in the wintertime.
With a tractor?
With a D8 tractor. That's how the Dew Line was built. Some of them were barged over in the summertime, you know, depending on the wind and the water. And actually, we built a lot of our field camps the same way. Kenny Tuvac would Harry would build the buildings.
Uh-huh.
Kenny would put them up on a Panacek along with a load of fuel and take off in the wintertime. And they'd go, well, what they'd always do is they'd go out and they'd put the building up and they'd get everything set, and then on their way back they'd take a detour, which is illegal as hell, which we never said anything, and they'd shoot a few caribou, and they'd come back with the Panacek loaded with, the most they ever got was 128 caribou
wow.
on one trip. Of course, there was 8 or 9 guys,
yeah,
you know.
Shared
them around town. So we always said that if they take this trip and do all this work for us, well, detour on the way back was their business. You know? They ran into problems or something.
You didn't know.
Well, we didn't know if the auditors asked us. Of course we didn't know. We couldn't, yeah. But life was different in those days. Hell, the auditors never left I don't think we had an auditor at Point Barrow until 68. So wow. They all stayed back either in Fairbanks or actually our contracting officer in those days was in Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
So when did you first go up to Barrow?
Spring of 1960.
And you were a scientist?
Went up as a scientist that first summer. Then I was hired out at the lab in September. Was it late August? Well, September of 1960. My wife came up in December of 1960.
And what were you hired as?
Just an administrative assistant in those days. About a year later, I was made assistant director.
And then you became director?
When Max left in 71. So 10 years I was assistant director.
And how long were you director?
Just 2.5. Okay, the summer of 71 was when Max went to Juneau to become the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. And the trouble was that was my daughter then, and Max is, no, let's see, 71, and Mary Lou moved down here, that's right. And then in 72, Mary Lou spent 71 to 72 here in town. And we came down after she moved to Juneau in 72, spring of 72 or June or July, I can't remember when. Then we bought that August, bought this house here. And because our daughter had graduated from the school up there, and that was as far as she could go, and there was no other school. So we had to make the move. So from August of 72 until Christmas of 73, when I left the lab, I commuted between Barrow and here. Every time I had a trip outside, I'd leave 2-3 days early so I could spend a year. Then on the way back, I'd spend 2-3 days. Right. Sometimes I'd go 2-3 weeks without leaving home, but that was the longest.
And that was when it took... How long did it take to fly?
Well, things were getting better then. They had just put the jets on. So, when I first went to Barrow, in 1960, this is interesting because I'm sure you live in Fairbanks. We left Fairbanks and flew to Thompson's Landing, which nobody even knows about anymore. It was a spot on the Yukon. Then we went from Thompson's Landing to Bettles, from Bettles to Umiat, and Umiat to Barrow. And it took, because the weather was bad and we spent a lot of time at places, it took 11 hours to get from Fairbanks to Barrow, my first trip. So it, I mean, we used to think when the F-27 came, that was, we were living in Clover. You know, we called this the screamer, the Fairchild with the turboprops that hung underneath. Oh, yeah, because, my God, you got a fast airplane, because everything was a DC-3 and a DC-6 in those days.
So then how long did the fast airplane take?
That would take about 1 hour and 50 minutes.
Oh, it's about what 2 hours.
Now. No, now it's 1 hour. 1 hour, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It was 2 hours, though. Just about twice that. So. And Screamer. Because this one does about 500, and the Screamer did about 350.
Screamer.
Yeah, they called it Screamer. Because it made that noise when it went over to land. It sounded like a woman screaming when it went over your house. Yeah. So we called it the Screamer.
You always tell when the plane's coming in.
Well, and see, in those days, there was no village airport. Uh-huh. It was only the one out at the Strip. In fact, it's very interesting when the storm of 63, which their house was destroying, So Suvalux, Pete Nice's house, was down on the beach level, and it was totally destroyed. And
They had just started working on the airport in the village. And they had just the dirt in place. You know, they had done nothing else on it. They'd been hauling the gravel and all that, putting it in place. When the storm came in October of 63 and just destroyed the camp airport totally.
Wow.
It just washed the gravel out from under the Marsden matting. And so they went over to the village, because this was October, and it, you know, like the 10 days later, it turned real cold. They just sprayed the surface of the village airport. They landed on the frozen gravel all winter long. And then they worked on the airport at camp and tried to get it done before the other one thawed the spring and melted. You know. And they just made it. You know.
Yeah.
They just managed to get the Marsden matting back in place so you can land out at the village. And then they landed the camp. And then they spent another year fixing the one up in the village and paving it. That was 63, 64. And there was no gas in the village prior to that, prior to the storm of 63. Senator Greening was working hard to get the law passed that would allow them to sell gas to the natives, because it was against, because of the Teapot Dome scandal, you know, government gas could not be sold to private.
I don't know what the
Teapot Dome scandal, well, that goes back. Teapot Dome scandal was what created the petroleum reserves back in the 20s. And the laws on the books forbade the government to sell to private individuals. And Greening was trying to pass a law to allow the government to sell gas to the natives. And actually, it was the storm of 63 that they all did it sort of as an acceleration because of the plight of the village. Prior to that, there's a story about Harry I never even thought of. We were helping Greening, you know, good government employees. Senator asks for something, you do what you're supposed to do. And Greening was making the case that it was terribly expensive for the people to heat their homes with oil. And houses in the village were about this big in those days. They all lived in the one room. You know. They were just, because they couldn't heat them. There's simply no way. So I was trying to run up a study of costs of heating oil against the costs of the gas. You know. So I went to Harry one day and I said, Harry, how much oil do you burn? He says, drop a month. I said, okay, that's that cold weather or warm weather? How much do you burn in January? Drop a month. How much do you burn in April? From a month. What do you do when it gets cold? Drum a month. When you run out, you're out. Because they couldn't afford more than one drum a month. I've forgotten that. And he just sat there with that little smile on his face. Drum a month. That's all he would say. You know? Until I finally got smart. Oh dear, I had forgotten something. It's terrible because that was the way Harry did everything, you know, that twinkle in his eye until you got the message, you know, sort of thing. Huh. I don't know why. I think Harry looked upon me as a kid. That's probably, six years younger? Six, 7 years younger? Something like that. Of course, his kids weren't really that much younger than me either. They had a heck of a lot of kids over a few years there. And all of the kids were working at the lab in those days. Every one of the Brown kids worked at the lab. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the reasons I have troubles keeping them all separate in my mind, you know, until I see them, I can't remember who, what, where, and when. Yeah. Like, you ask any of them about yellow paint, you know, because every summer, well, had to paint a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Outside surfaces don't last long with that blowing snow up there, you know. And so we'd always have a painting crew out every summer, because you only have 6 weeks to paint them. And of course, that makes a perfect job for the kids who are coming back from school. And they all got so sick of swinging paintbrushes. You just say yellow paint to them, they just sort of, they don't have anything to do with it, yeah. Hell, even Bill was that way. And Bill, I think, one winter, he worked, I think, in the staff room with all the scientific equipment. Phil did that for years. Phil's super lucky. Yeah. And was very good at it. I've never seen a guy like Phil. He would sit there with the catalogs and study them until he knew what every... He may not know what the machine did or what the instrument did, but he knew what it looked like. When someone asked for it, he could get it.
Wow.
And of course, over the years, he learned what they did too and how they did it. I think one of the biggest contributions that the lab made up there, I'm digressing very
well,
really was the fact that we weren't condescending to the people. We needed them, and they needed us. You know, I think that was the biggest thing we brought up there. This was not a make work thing, type, you know, like mm-hmm. Do good or EEO type thing. It was simply a necessity. And so they felt, they had a good feeling of pride in what they did. Because they were bringing something unique that only they could bring to the job. Mm-hmm. And that was important in those days. I remember, oh God, was it the 80s when the horrible times were? When Pete and Isis boy killed that couple out on the point.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
80, 81?
Or was it in the 70s?
If it's 70s, it's late 70s. Yeah. 79, maybe. Pete died the same year. Pete never knew that. Oh. Yeah. He was in the hospital at the time, I remember that. And they never told him. But that was... Things were rough in the village. At that time, I was working for Husky. We were doing the exploration of the petroleum reserve, and you know, we had people coming in and out and back and forth going through Barrow. And it got to the point that our contractors would not go into the village. Mm-hmm. We had to hire airplanes to fly them to someplace else to get them out of there. Because mm-hmm. they would drive to go to the airport, and they'd get to the airport with 2 and 3 bullet holes in the windows.
Jeez.
Just to the car. It was terrible, and I went up there about 3 times through that, and I must admit, it never crossed my mind to even worry about it. You know, Barrow was home to me, and, mm-hmm. and so I didn't even think about it, until after about my 4th trip, someone says, "You came through the village?" You know? And I'm like, "Oh my God, yeah." I said, "You know, not everybody knows me." Someone could get, it just never had dawned on me, but people were just scared.
And what was the reason for this?
There was a tremendous... the best way I can explain this is that part of the trouble was when the land claims was settled and when all of... At the same time that the land claims was settled, the borough was born. I mean, they're not the same year, but they're all within a couple of years of each other here. And so they started getting taxes, and they had been sold a bill of goods that it was going to be all land of milk and honey, and nobody would have to do anything. It would just sit around, sit home, and the world would take care of them. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it didn't work that way. And a lot of this was the politicians. I mean, and natives have their bad politicians just as well as anybody else. I mean, but in those days, nobody felt that way. You know, they believed everything that was said. And there was a tremendous backlash when the white man was still getting all the good jobs, was still getting the high-paying stuff on the slip. And they weren't. And it was... There was a tremendous period of backlash there. It was really very, very strong.
So it was animosity against the white people, not against their own native politicians.
No, they took it, yeah, it was because the white men were, well, Charlie Anderson, good old he took. He was a big one of these. He would stand there and just, I was director of the lab, I will never forget. You know, I know Charlie for years, at least. And he came out to the office one day with, I just irritated the hell out of me because we had beautiful rugs and everything at the lab in those days. Probably they still do. And with those damn muddy boots, he sat in my office and put the muddy boots on my desk. And he says, by next year, I'll have your job. You know, just like that. And I, of course, blew and threw Charlie out. But that was their attitude. They just hated everything that was white. They were going to take it all over. And because they really... I mean, if they could have done so, if the economics were there, I think I would have encouraged it. But hell, the United States government couldn't afford to keep that lab going. How in the hell could the borough afford to keep it going? They've done a magnificent job, don't get me wrong. I'm really very, very proud of them. And I'm amazed, you know, George and all the rest of them have done a pretty damn good job. They deserve a lot of credit.
It's certainly nothing like it was in the 40s and 50s.
But it couldn't be.
Because of the money, yeah.
Yeah. No, the 60s were the 60s and 70s, early 70s were the boom years.
Okay.
When I left is when it started going downhill. But it was just, I mean boom. It was really, the big thing, and lots of people don't know this, because the Air Force was in there, you know, and the lab sort of, when the Air Force first came in and took over the camp, One of the responsibilities they took on was the lab. And because they didn't want to be bothered with all the bookkeeping and all the crap, they just took it on.
Yeah.
And so there were only, what, 15 people at the lab in those days. They ate at the mess hall, they got heat and light, all those things, all for nothing. Well, then over the years, the lab grew, and there was no reimbursement. And at one point, we had something like 65 and 70 people eating off the Air Force for nothing. I mean, it was unbelievable. And so over the years, and Max Brewer was a master at this, you know, playing the Navy off against the Air Force. We ended up paying ridiculously low. I think one time we were paying $3 a day per person. Of course, in those days, I think it was $15 a day was the going rate, you know, when we were. And over, and we would get... like all of our supplies would be delivered, fuel and everything, for the cost of them, no freight. Because the Air Force paid it out of their bill of lading business, you know, on the barges and everything. And it was just included in the other stuff. So for years, there was really no cost to the lab or the Navy for the logistics at the lab. So the Navy put all their money into science. Well, then some hotshots got into the Navy, and actually for years the Navy and the Air Force fought over who could have the responsibility for the camp. Because it was a prestigious thing in those days, you know, as far as the military was concerned. And the Navy finally won out because they owned it, of course. And then all of a sudden, 3 years later, they couldn't afford it. So they shut it down. It's typical military and government, you know. Well, I'm sure. Where the heck is the? There is a history of the lab. I don't know if you've ever
seen it. Yeah, I've looked at it.
Of course, that's Reed and Ron Hovday, I think, is that one. Yeah. But there are other things that are better than that. Really, that's not what I would call. John Reed was a very good friend. I didn't know Ron Hovday very well. John Reed just died recently in Indiana in a restaurant. But he was a very close friend. Over the years, and very active in the Arctic. John did lots of good things for the Arctic. You know. In 60, John, in October of 1960, that summer John had retired from the USGS. He never was director, he was acting director of the survey. And he had retired that year and become the director of the Arctic Institute of North America. I met him in October of 1960, I remember the first time. And he had just taken over the job as director of AINA, which in those days was a big active participant in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. You hear much about him now? You hear about Dave Norton? He was AINA. Now it's Carl Francis. You know him? Mm-hmm. Carl, I guess, is retired. He's geology? Was he over at the Geophysical Institute? He did snow ice research. I think he was at the Geophysical Institute. But he's been doing it now. Did I say Carl Francis?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Sorry, Carl Francis is the guy down here. Carl.
Oh.
Snow and ice research. His wife is Ruth. He's a nurse.
I'm going to say Benson.
Benson, thank you. Yes, Carl Benson.
I've heard the name, but I don't know.
Okay, that's terrible. Like I said, my mind is going. And he bugs me about once every 6 months, so I should remember his name.
So you worked for Husky Oil. Did you work for them when Harry had his lawsuit?
I don't remember. I honestly... Harry's lawsuit was which one, Hal?
The one I remember him telling me about was... I think it was against Husky Oil for ruining his trap line.
Oh, he never really sued.
No, he didn't?
No. That was... I was with Husky at the time, yeah. He wrote him a letter threatening to sue. He never sued. Well, now, wait a minute.
He told me he was in court, so maybe I...
Yes. What's his name? The judge at Barrow.
Mike Jeffries?
Jeffries. Jeffries was the Vista lawyer volunteer in those days. He had just come to Barrow. And I think you're right, Harry did sue. And Harry and I, when I saw him that one time, I says, we don't want to talk about the suit. I do remember that. Now, it was a suit. I saw the letter, and I dealt with the letter only because I stayed away from the lawsuit. And if I remember correctly, he got quite a bit of money out of that. There were two things. One was a boat, and I'm trying to remember whose boat it was. It was hit by a cat, crushed, you know. And the other one was Harry's, that they drove over the trap line.
Yeah.
And... if I remember correctly, Husky paid them immediately and then had to go back and ask Harry and who was the other person? Johnny Tukak. Not to cash the check. Because as far as Husky was concerned, it was their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But then their corporate lawyers wanted to make the subcontractors, insurance companies, pay. And so it was a big mess. And I remember going in with the letter. I went down to Cody, Wyoming. That's where Husky's headquarters was in those days. Walked in and talked to Jim Nielsen, and he didn't bat an eye. He said, pay it, for God's sake. Well, give me that crap. He was not that type of person. And so he scribbled across the bottom of Harry's letter, as I recall. And I took that and dropped it off with the people who paid bills, the accountants there. And that was the last I ever saw of it. But then I can remember there was something about the subcontractors and the insurance companies, and it got very complicated.
Yeah.
But Harry got paid, finally. But I think it was Max that had to ask him not to cash the check. Yeah. I can't remember. I was not involved in that part of it. No, it wasn't Max. Someone talked to Eugene. Maybe it was Carol Livingston. The husband of the gal that painted those. Yeah.
Do you remember about what year it might have been?
It has to be about 80 or 81. Let's see, I went to work for Husky in 76 and quit in 83. It's got to be 81, spring of 81 when that happened. Yeah, I think it was the year they were working on the Barrow gas fields and doing a lot of hauling and stuff that probably was never happened. Yeah. I had really forgotten that.
Another thing Harry talked about, I don't know if how many were, if you were, you probably would have been at the lab, because I'm going to ask Max this also. But Harry talked to me once about a time when there was a whaling accident, a boat flipped or something, and he made it sound like he went to the lab and asked for help with a helicopter or something. Do you remember such a thing?
It happened so many times that I'm not too sure. I can't remember one that Harry was involved. I remember a bomb going bad and blowing up and didn't really have the gun. You know.
Uh-huh.
I remember that happening. Was that?
Yeah, and it's funny. It's a story that I don't...
I think that helicopter one was after I left and after Max left. I think that's John Kelly's direct... No. Oh, the guy who came in after me. An idiot. Warren Denner was director. Yeah, I think so. Because when Max and I were there, we would just do it. You know, we never argued. And we had, I'll never forget, we had a contracting officer that was absolutely the world's best. I could tell Bill Gerken, like, you know, like, these people are natives. They get millions of government money from the Public Health Service, from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and everything. If they need this, and we could do it for them cheaper and quicker than the other agencies can, Bill would say, if it's cheaper, I can't see that the United States government would ever want to make itself spend more money than it has to. I mean, that was his attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And you could justify almost anything if you could prove to him that you could do it cheaper. And so we did search and rescue a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt this was right, you know. As far as he was concerned, this was the way. If the government's going to pay for search and rescue anyway, then do it for the people that are on hand who can do it the cheapest.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was his attitude. And so we really had no trouble with Bill Gerken. And we had a lot of wonderful support in Washington, both Max and I. Max had Max Brewer had Max Britton. In those days, Max Britton, by the way, is still going strong, 83, not 84. Brewer was just back east and stopped to see the Britons a few days ago. That's where he was on his trip.
Uh-huh.
We were coming down here. He went and saw his son and then stopped to see the Britons.
Yeah.
Another cute little, there was a guy by the name of Louis Kwan, who's still living, but he's in a nursing home now, who was Max Britton's boss. And we had a fellow out of, California, UCLA, John Moore, who's still alive, and he was a pain in my side for years. He's an activist environmentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And the older he got, the more difficult he got to even talk to. And when I was working for the government writing environmental impact statements on oil exploration...
Mm-hmm.
He was writing me letters constantly. Anyway, John Moore, this is a very long way to get around to this story. John Moore called Max Brewer, Max Minimum, called Max Britton, Max Maximum, and called Louis Kwan, who was Max's boss, the Max Master. But that was the kind of a crowd. See, now that was the scientist who came to Barrow. But in those days, it was such a small group, really. And even years later, even now, when we get together for an AINA meeting or the AAAS or stuff like that, where we're seeing each other, the number of people who really do work in the Arctic is not that many. So that over the years, it's sort of become a fraternity or a sorority or something, some sort of a club that you know just about everybody in it.
Well, it's a good need. The thing that, from knowing Harry, got me interested in it, and now it's going to become my other little pet topic besides Harry's life, is the further history of the lab and the Native participation with the scientists. And my thinking that they didn't get as much credit as maybe they should have, or did they?
I think they did, but it was never... Well, I've got speeches downstairs where I can tell you that I made at the 25th anniversary of the lab, and where I made a very strong thank you to the people of Barrow. Uh-huh. Because we had gotten to the point we depended on them, you know, that was very... somewhere, you probably would not think about this, but there's an issue of Arctic, you know?
Yeah,
the journal.
Yeah.
An old issue of Arctic that was dedicated... Well, I can tell you the year exactly, because it was the 25th anniversary of the lab. So what's that, 82? 70? 72. Yeah, 72.
Okay.
In which I made this speech, and that's in that issue. All of the, you know, they invited all the old scientists to give things. And a lot of the credit that the natives got, I must admit, was pretty low-key, because they were thanked, like in the preamble to a scientific article, where you wouldn't think to look for that kind of stuff, and yet you'd be surprised at the number of scientists who knew what invaluable help they had gotten, and they would mention it, you know, when they were writing their reports and stuff. In fact, there's a fellow by the name of Jess Walker. You know Jess?
I've met him. He's a barrel. Not so long ago.
Yeah, yeah, Jess still goes back. Well, Jess and Rita are from Baton Rouge, and Brewer and I, and George Grich and a few others, are floating to Colorado in May together. And this is this old crowd that Troy Payway started all this. He used to teach geology at Fairbanks.
Huh.
And Troy went to Tempe, and right after he got down there teaching geology, that would be about 65, 66, he started these yearly trips with his students on the Colorado River teaching the geology.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 2 years ago we were going to all get together and do it, because Troy insisted that was his last year, and he got very ill. He got over his health problems, and then we were going to do it last year, and he had so many students beating on him because he hadn't done it the year before that he did only the students last year. So this year we're going.
Great. Yeah, well, I've looked, and I know there are certain scientists who make it very clear about the native help they receive, but other ones, it's not.
Well, that's partly, I think, a reflection of the culture. They're the ones who don't make it really clear were the kids coming along.
The kids of the scientific community?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, not the. Well, and then as you come along in the years, the kids in the village didn't do as much anymore like they used to. It was back in the 60s where this was a real...